The name of God, the beneficent, the merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe, peace and blessings upon his servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Ameen. I greet you with a greeting that is common in Islam, Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our fourth program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be discussing the topic of the Islamic approach to consumption. I have joining me on the program as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
First, I wonder if I could ask you to explain the connection between today's topic and the last three topics that we've been discussing in this series dealing with the economic system of Islam.
Certainly. In the first three topics, what we dealt with was mainly the basic principles upon which a proper Islamic economy or ideal Islamic economy can be established. The first program was mainly broader principles, theoretical foundations, or conceptual foundations. In the second and third program, we dealt with some of the fundamental principles also, or concepts, which shape the nature of Islamic economy, one of which is the attitude towards property rights, which is a basic thing in any theory or system of economics. And secondly, was the concept or attitude towards labor or work. However, these principles do not show us in a more specific and concrete way how does an ideal Islamic economy should operate. In order to get into that, today's topic would be one helpful step on the way. In other words, you have to find out first what is the attitude of Islamic principles towards the question of consumption theory. What is the attitude towards production, the attitude towards distribution and determination of prices in the marketplace? What is the role of the money, especially monetary issues? The role of government in the economy, to what extent can the government intervene or help keep the economy moving in the right direction? So in a way, we're really moving into some more concrete way as to how this concept could operate within the context of an economic system.
Well, now, in order to perhaps get a good understanding of Islam's approach to consumption, it might be helpful if we were to start off and contrast it with the common notion or the common conception of consumption in the West. Could you perhaps give us your understanding of the Western theory of consumption to begin with?
Okay, well, in the Western economy, as you know, it is based largely, in some degree or the other, on the principles of capitalism. And capitalism, in turn, was based on the so-called Protestant ethics. A good reference for that is Max Weber's The Protestant Ethics and the Spirit of Capitalism, published in 1958. This is one source of people, or reference, where the theory of capitalism and its relationship to Protestant ethics is articulated and explained. But in this approach, in capitalism, there are two basic pillars for consumption theory, or how an individual consumer decides as to what he or she wishes to buy or obtain. The first is called rationalism, which means that an individual, by his nature, in his own economic behavior, tries his or her best to be very cautious, careful, to calculate risks and benefits for the purpose of achieving the ultimate objective, which is economic success. That implies then that acquisition of wealth is the criterion, is the yardstick to judge whether or not you have an economic success. It is the criterion or measure by which you can tell whether the person really has succeeded to use this rationalism in getting what he or she wants. That's one principle. The second basic principle or pillar of the capitalist economy is called utilitarianism, which means that things are to be evaluated depending on how useful they are to you. saying anything. In other words, this book is, you know, is beneficial to me, is useful to me, so it has some value to me. Okay? But that also goes beyond commodities. Even moral principles are sometimes evaluated on this utilitarian basis. In other words, check honesty. Under utilitarian theory, honesty is good so long as it's beneficial to you.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're an honest merchant, and this honesty helps you to get credit from the bank, get customers, it's good. So it is useful to you. But if the same moral principle, let's say honesty, seems to work against your economic interest and economic success, which is the ultimate goal under the capitalist system, then you may discard it. You know, it's a matter of whether or not it benefits you at a given time. These two basic principles seem to reflect a particular philosophy. And as you indicated in previous programs, you can't talk about economics without relating them to philosophical ideas, without relating them to religious convictions. So these ideas, rationalism and utilitarianism, seem both to stem from a philosophy of man, or human, that the human is basically what economists call an economic man, or as some people call, using the same attitude or approach in anthropology, they call him homo economicus. That is a person who is basically an economic man, working mainly in order to acquire more and more wealth, to acquire more and more economic success, and that is the ultimate goal that the individual can hope to attain.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in the context of the theory that you've just outlined, how does the consumer decide what to buy, what commodities to buy, or what services to acquire?
Okay, in the initial formulation of the capitalist theory in economics, they used something called marginal analysis, which was later modified a little bit or improved using something called the equality between the marginal rates of substitution, but we won't get into all this technical thing in indifference curves.
Although the study is making a little bit dizzy.
All right, yeah. Especially get to indifference curves and the slope of the indifference curve and how the person... But to put it in a simpler way that hopefully everyone can follow. Basically, as a consumer, when I decide to buy things, I have to consider, first of all, the limits on my income, or income constraints, as it's called. You know, what is the maximum amount of income that I may have available to me to buy the variety of goods and services available? And then each person would have to think, would it be more beneficial overall to me to spend all that money buying one item, two items, or three items? How much really can I vary the combination or mix of goods and services in a way to attain the maximum utility? Like, you know, those economics professors use this old good example in classroom about a combination between apples and oranges. You know, that if you have certain amount of money and it costs so much to buy an apple and so much to buy an orange or banana, then a person would have to find out how far do I really get maximum satisfaction by getting all oranges or apples, or how many units of orange and apple within the restriction and constraints, of course, of the total income. So this is basically, I'm putting it in a very simple way, basically a marginal analysis to find out what is the maximum utility that can be attained by a particular mix of commodities and services.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in contrast to that, how does Islam's approach differ or compare with the common approach, this common approach to consumption?
Well, in a very nice work on economics, a recent one that I think we referred to previously and from which we can borrow, is the book called The Islamic Economy, in English, by Dr. Munzer Kahf. And he summarizes it in a nice way, in a very concise and brief way, in terms of five basic differences between Islamic economy and capitalist economy. One relates to the concept of success. Secondly, the time scale in the consumer behavior, or the time horizon when the person makes decisions to buy certain things. Thirdly, the concept of wealth. Fourthly, the concept of goods. Many people keep talking about goods and services. What is the definition? What's the meaning of goods? And fifthly, certain aspects pertaining to the ethics of consumption in Islam.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps we could examine some of these differences in a little bit more detail. To begin with, what makes the, what distinguishes the Islamic concept of success from the conventional economic assumptions
that
are in the West?
As was mentioned earlier, the capitalist approach, of course, is the idea that success is mainly economic success. So you're evaluated, your value, your importance, your success is basically measured in economic success, how much you could acquire of wealth, or you have succeeded to acquire. In Islam, however, success is there, but it is not exclusively measured in terms of acquisition of wealth. Success in Islam is not merely success in the economic sense. That's too much bias, as viewed by Islam. The ultimate success, if you put it in a more broad format, the ultimate success for the Muslim is to achieve the pleasure of God. To live a way which is virtuous, a life which is harmonious,
mm-hmm.
where there's complete harmony between the material needs of the human, moral needs, social needs, all these are integrated together in an integrated whole. So the moral virtues and moral values are part also of evaluating whether or not a person is successful, not just the amount of money. Well, this means then, basically, is that economic success or progress or acquiring wealth is not and should not be regarded by a Muslim as an end in itself. It's not the ultimate of your success, but rather a means to an end which is loftier, which is more noble and more important. But to make sure again that this is not misunderstood, this does not mean or imply in any way that Islam regards wealth as vice in itself or regards poverty as virtuous. There's nothing virtuous about poverty at all. But the idea here is to understand and to have the awareness that life has so many facets, one of which, yes, is economics. It is important, but it is part of it. Just like saying a man does not live by bread alone, but he cannot live without bread either.
Mm-hmm.
So you need really to integrate and consider both material and other needs of the human. The idea then is to arrive at some kind of balance in one's life within the limits of Islamic law or Sharia, and in a way which does not constitute any deviation from the basic moral teaching or moral values of Islam, and without harming oneself or others.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the differences that you remarked on has to do with the time scale of consumption.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that may not be that familiar with all of our viewers, but I'd have to ask you to explain what the time scale of consumption means in the Islamic context.
Okay, this actually refers to the time horizon or time dimension. That is, whenever you take a decision, you always think, what is the consequence of that, or what are the consequences of that decision in the next hour, in the next day, week, a year, 5 years? So that's what it refers to. What kind of time frame influences your decision as a consumer? Now, I indicated earlier that this is also different in the case of Islam than capitalism, because in capitalism, all right, during my lifetime or before I reach the age of 40 or 50, how much wealth I may be successful in acquiring. But in the mind of a true Muslim, when you think even economically, you think in a much broader time horizon or time scale, because you think that any action that you take today will not only affect your well-being or welfare in the next week, month, or year, but it will affect you forever. One basic and fundamental belief in Islam is the belief in the life hereafter, in paradise and hellfire, and that each person would have to stand alone before God to give account of his or her life on earth. If nobody can take responsibility for my action or your action, everybody would have to give his account directly to God. And this has an important motivational force, because any action or decision you take, you don't say, all right, what is my benefit next year? You also think, what is the consequence of that action on my part, even in the life hereafter, in addition to this life? This is one thing. Another angle or viewpoint that you can look at it also is that Islam emphasizes in its teaching, and you find that throughout the Quran, the common bond between humanity, and that any particular generation or group of people are not the only people who are living on this planet, are not the only people who can claim that they have achieved something on this earth. But a human should be humble and realize that he or she is only one part of a caravan of creation, caravan of human beings who lived hundreds and thousands of years before, and those who are going to live also in the future. This also will affect the time scale of your decision. Even as a consumer, you might not see the connection immediately, but we'll see how it connects. It means that when you decide, for example, to harness the various resources in the universe, or natural resources, you're not only thinking about the selfish need of one generation, because your religious teaching teach you that you should also be considerate to future generations, which means that you have no right to squander and abuse natural resources, saying that, all right, for our generation it doesn't matter because by the time these resources are exhausted or damaged or the environment is damaged, it would take another couple of hundred years, so I don't care, myself and my children will not suffer. No. In Islam it says, how about other human beings, how about other descendants in the future? So the time horizon also is much larger than the benefit or immediate economic dollars and cents terms of one particular generation or group of people. In other words, it's a question of maximization, if you want to use the maximization, but not maximization in a restrictive sense, but maximization of overall well-being of the person in this life and in the hereafter of this generation as well as a future generation.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about the attitude towards wealth and goods?
Well, in the question of wealth, we can just make cross-reference at this point to the second program in this series, which dealt with the property rights. But I think it's useful to make cross-reference here and indicate that basically, in the matter of wealth, Islam sees an important need to integrate the various facets of human life, material and spiritual, and that, as indicated before, poverty is not regarded as a virtue in itself at all. In fact, Sayyidina Umar, the second caliph after Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was quoted once as saying that if poverty was a man, I would have killed him. The Prophet himself used in his supplications and prayers, and he says, Allahumma inna a'udhuka min al-kufri wal-faqr. O Allah, O God, I seek refuge in you from disbelief and poverty. So you consider poverty as something as evil and as bad as disbelief, because when people are, of course, starved and in bad shape, they are driven into acts which they would otherwise not do if they were not really in great need. So there is no virtue in poverty. So wealth itself is not regarded in Islam as something which is negative, provided that it is acquired legitimately, utilized legitimately, and all other duties and obligations on this wealth has also been fulfilled. I remember in more than one program in the past, we quoted one key verse in the Quran, in chapter 28, verse 77. وَابْتَغِ فِي مَا أَتَاكَ اللَّهُ الدَّارَ الْآخِرَةِ وَلَا تَنْسَ نَصِيبَكَ مِنَ الدُّنْيَا وَأَحْسِنْ كَمَا أَحْسَنَ اللَّهُ إِلَيْكَ وَلَا تَبْغِ الْفَسَادَ فِي الْأَرْضِ إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُحِبُّ الْمُسْرِفِينَ. Very nice summary of the attitude towards life and wealth. It says that seek in what God has provided you the hereafter, and other work also for the hereafter. But do not forget your share in this life. So there's nothing wrong also enjoying in this life. And be good as God has been good to you, and do not cause mischief on earth, because God doesn't like those who make mischief on earth. So this summarizes that wealth is good, provided, of course, that it has this kind of limitation, other section. As far as the question of good, that's an interesting question, because in the strict economic sense, any item is called good if it has a utility or benefit to someone somewhere. Now, I'm not talking about the legal sense. If the item could be illegal, mm-hmm. but economically, it has a value. Example, you could say that this pen has a utility. It is an economic good because it is useful for someone to write. Fine. But how about hash, opium, heroin, damaging alcoholic drinks, and they all are All right. In the strict economic sense, aside from the legality, of course, you could say that heroin is illegal. But economically speaking, in the Western sense, and the capitalist economy, that heroin has a utility because somebody somewhere feels that it is useful to him. It might be damaging, but he gets some benefit. He gets high out of that. So that's a benefit, and economically speaking, it's regarded as good. Now, the Islamic view is quite different than that. Actually, the proper term for good that we find in the Quran, there are two related terms, at-tayyibat and al-rizq. The word tayyibat in Arabic, which appears in the Quran describing commodities, can be translated to give meaning such as wholesome things, pure things, clean things, but not useful in the sense of any kind of usefulness. Rizq, as another term also, is used to refer to something or cannot gift from God, something that is bestowed on humanity by God, provision that God has given to humanity. Of course, you're entitled to ask, what does that all relate to the question of definition of what is an economic good in Islam? Mm-hmm. Well, it does relate, because in Islamic concepts, an item which is harmful, like heroin, for example, cannot be regarded as an economic good either. Mm-hmm. And as such, its production, distribution, and consumption are all prohibited in Islam. It's not regarded as an economic good even that falls within the category of permissible things. So there is a little different emphasis there on how you identify something as useful.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, to conclude today's program, I wonder...
The other thing also is with respect to the consumption or use of this good, that you can consume things. The basic rule or the foundation really in Islam is that things are permissible unless otherwise specified as illegitimate. Okay? Which means that enjoyment in itself is permissible. You don't have to say, all right, is this permissible? If it's not prohibited, it is automatically regarded as permissible. In fact, the Quran puts it in a very nice way, not only to show us that it is permissible, but it shows that we have no right to make things which you could consume or use, which God has permitted you. You have no right to make it forbidden for no good reason. In chapter 7, verse 32 in the Quran, it says, كُلْ مَنْ حَرَّمَ زِينَةَ اللَّهِ الَّتِي أَخْرَجَ لِعِبَادِهِ وَالطَّيِّبَاتِ مِنَ الرِّزْقِ. Saying, who, or by whose authority, has anyone forbidden the adornment and good provision and good wholesome things that God has created for his servants, and also this good provision? So there is no hang up on consumption of good. However, we find that the Quran also provides, to come to your question, some ethical boundaries or ethical guidelines as to how you go about consuming those goods and or services. Two basic extremes have to be avoided. One, a person should not be too stingy. If God has blessed him or her with provisions, one should not just keep hoarding wealth and not benefiting himself from that or making his family also benefit from it. That's one thing. But on the other hand, the other extreme also is condemned in Islam. The fact that you own wealth, that you have legitimately acquired wealth, does not mean that you're not ethically and morally required not to be too extravagant, not to be too wasteful in the use of that wealth. Of course, the definition of waste is a matter, of course, that depends on the circumstances of the time and the kind of customs or norms in a given society. But I think most people can appreciate when you say being too extravagant and very wasteful in the use of resources or wealth available to you. And both of these extremes have been mentioned in the Quran in more than one place, but in one place, for example, in chapter 17, verse 29, it says, it puts it very nice. It says, وَلَا تَجْعَلْ يَدَكَ مَغْلُولَةً إِلَىٰ عَنُقِكَ وَلَا تَبْسُطْهَا كُلَّ الْبَسْطِ فَتَقْعُدَ مَلُومًا مَحْسُورًا. Don't keep your hand too close to your neck, again, a symbol of being too stingy. And don't extend it all the way, a symbol again of being too wasteful and too extravagant in expenditure. So this is one thing. The other thing also pertains to some of the basic rules in Islamic law as one aspect of the ethics of consumption. That your utilization of wealth should not be in such a way so as to harm yourself or harm other people. So these are some of the boundaries that somehow determine how the person should move or go about enjoying the various bounties of God on earth without falling into any of the prohibited actions that is not regarded as wholesome from the standpoint of
mm-hmm. Well, I think we'll conclude our program for today. We've pretty much exhausted our time. We want to invite you all back next week and we'll continue our discussion of the economic system of the Quran. We'll be discussing production and distribution. We want to thank you for watching our program. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.